Hi, everybody. This is Brett. Welcome back to School Sucks. Today is October 10th. First question, right? What is a podcast master? Well, first of all, it is pronounced podcast master, and it's a lot of things. Podcast Masters Liberty Masterclass is a new format, a very occasional format, just one time a month, the first Monday of every month, combining the School Sucks live show with the Liberty Conspiracy live show. So it will be me, Jason Osborne, and Gardner Goldsmith. I'm going to review what we've done on our show, each of our shows in the last month, some of the decisions that we've made, successes, failures, hopefully interact with people through the chat on Ustream, and take some calls from LRN and Ustream listeners and viewers. And so I'm excited about seeing this format evolve. The point of doing this is listener participation, so I hope come the first Monday in November, people will be ready to participate. So think about what happens over the course of the next month on my show. Of course, if you listen to Gardner's show, same thing. And think about getting involved with us on the first Monday of November. That will be the next installment of Podcast Masters Liberty Masterclass. And that's also a working title. We're really still open to suggestions. That is a very silly title. I understand. It is absolutely intentional. And you know, folks, I've always said part of being a podcast master is having a great audience, building a great audience. And we've certainly done that. I want to say thanks to a couple of people who really helped me out in the past week. First of all, a listener named Yehera, who has been very kind donating to the show through a service called Venmo. This is a PayPal alternative. She is a super, super fan, and she's been extremely kind. The money will probably be spent on a camcorder, and I'm shopping around right now for that. I did get as a donation a DSLR camera, but it has some limitations for video. I am still planning to use it for certain things, but I realized that I just need a kind of simple push button and forget about camcorder to do video coverage of some things that we're going to be doing in the future. So that's probably going to be the next purchase. I also want to thank Brian. Brian, who you just heard on the show recently, made a very helpful purchase off our Amazon wish list. There's a little piece of equipment. It's called the Triton Fethead. It's an inline preamp that will sufficiently power the Shure SM7B microphone that I purchased last year. The Shure microphone, which I haven't been using, didn't sound like a $300 microphone because I didn't have enough clean gain to run it through the equipment that I have. But with the Fethead, that will change. So by next week, I think, we're going to have a better sounding show. So before we move on, huge thanks to Yehera. Huge thanks to Brian. You both really helped School Sucks Project over the last week. Thank you so much. Now, I have edited down the full 2.5 hour show into a Podcast Masters Selects, you know, just the parts that I thought people would most enjoy listening to. There is full video available on the website if you enjoy this format. But I want to add a little bit of value before we get into the live discussion, and I want to talk about an author we have not talked enough about on the School Sucks show. And that is Samuel Blumenfeld. Blumenfeld is an author and an educator. Gardner is a big Samuel Blumenfeld fan. He's actually had Samuel Blumenfeld on his show. Sam has published 10 books on the topic of education in America, and most of his work has focused on what he identifies as a decline in American literacy, along with the increasing rate of learning disabilities and the increasing rate of children labeled with ADHD. He is another example of someone who is not a perfect philosophical ally for School Sucks, but, you know, who is these days? And one of Sam's interesting contributions that Gardner mentions is that years back, he combed through the NEA, National Education Association, meeting archives to see if he could identify a hidden agenda behind public schooling in America. And he absolutely did do that. So if you're interested in learning more about Blumenfeld, I wanted to provide for you the names of a few of his books. How to Tutor, written in 1998. The Victims of Dick and Jane, written in 2003. Dick and Jane was a series of Basel readers. Basel readers are texts designed to teach reading at the primary school levels, and of course the Dick and Jane books, which I think came into wide circulation in the 1930s, really focused on this look-say method of reading that we're going to talk a little bit more about today. Also, Is Public Education Necessary? Written in 1981. How to Start Your Own Private School and Why You Need One? Written in 1972. Homeschooling, A Parent's Guide to Teaching Children, written in 1997, and the book that I want to read from today, NEA, Trojan Horse in American Education, written in 1984. So two neglected subjects, certainly on School Sucks, and we're going to try to address two birds with one stone. First of all, the scholarship of Samuel Blumenfeld, and second, a in-depth study of the NEA, which we will revisit on the show in the future. I wanted to read today from Trojan Horse, Chapter 11, The Conspiracy Against Literacy. Nothing has mystified Americans more than the massive decline in literacy in the United States. Children spend more time in school, and the government spends more money on education than ever before. Yet, reading ability keeps declining. What has gone wrong? The Department of Education estimates that there are 24 million functional illiterates in the United States, virtually all of whom have had 8 to 12 years of compulsory public schooling. Contrast this with the figures for illiteracy in 1910 issued by the U.S. Bureau of Education and quoted in the January 30, 1915 issue of James McKean Cattell's own weekly publication, School and Society. Quote, statistics compiled by the Bureau of Education for use in the Panana Pacific Exposition show that children from 10 to 14 years of age were in 1910 only 22 out of every 1,000 who could neither read nor write. In 1900, there were of the same class 42 per 1,000. The following states report only one child in 1,000 between the ages of 10 and 14 is illiterate: Connecticut, District of Columbia, Massachusetts, Minnesota, Montana, New Hampshire, North Dakota, Oregon, Utah, and Washington. It is evident that the public schools will in a short time practically eliminate illiteracy. Unquote. So, end of excerpt. So apparently they knew how to teach children to read in 1910. There was also no such thing as functional illiteracy, that is, a kind of low inadequate reading ability, which is the product of faulty teaching methods in our schools. The illiteracy of 1910 was the result of some children having no schooling. Functional illiteracy is the result of the way we actually teach children to read in our school, for our teachers today, whether they know it or not, have been deliberately trained to produce functional illiteracy. To believe that such immense functional illiteracy is an unplanned phenomenon beyond the control of anyone is to believe that our educators, with all of their doctoral degrees, literally don't know what they're doing. After all, teaching children to read is no big mystery. Teachers have been doing it for the last 3,000 years, and the U.S. government's own statistics show they were doing it well in 1910 and up to about the 1930s, when the big switch took place in teaching methods. It is always possible for educators to make mistakes, but what is an equally strange phenomenon is the intense resistance the educators have put up to any suggestion of reform of reading instruction methods in our schools. For example, the Reading Reform Foundation was founded in 1963 to attempt to restore phonics to its proper place in reading instruction in American schools. Since its inception, the foundation has met nothing but hostility and resistance from the educational establishment. Many individual teachers have responded to the foundation's message, but the establishment as a whole has simply ignored, discounted, or resisted it. This writer was taught to read in the public schools of New York City back in the early 1930s. In those days, they still used phonics. That is, they taught the alphabet and the sounds the letters stand for, and before you knew it, you could read. In those days, dyslexia was unknown, and there were no functional illiterates or reading disabled children. Organically caused dyslexia did exist, but it was so rare that most people never even heard of it. Everyone in school, including the not-so-bright and the culturally disadvantaged minorities, learned to read. Today, even the very bright have a terrible time learning to read. Why? It was John Dewey who first formulated the notion that high literacy is an obstacle to socialism. The authors of The Dewey School, in recounting the history of the laboratory school, wrote in 1936, quote, "Too much emphasis cannot be laid upon the fact that undue premium is put on the ability to learn to read at a certain chronological age." Ellipses. "The entertainment plus information motive for reading conduces much to the habit of solitary self-entertainment, which ends too often in daydreaming instead of guided creative activities controlled by objective success or failure." End of excerpt.
All of this echoed what Dewey had written in 1896, after the laboratory school had been in operation for 9 months. Quote, "It is one of the great mistakes of education to make reading and writing constitute the bulk of the schoolwork in the first 2 years. The true way to teach them, incidentally, as the outgrowth of the social activities at this time. Thus, language is not primarily the expression of thought, but the means of social communication." Ellipses. If language is abstracted from social activity and made an end in itself, it will not give its whole value as a means of development. Ellipses. It is not claimed that by the method suggested, the child will learn to read as much, nor perhaps as readily in a given period as by the usual method, that he will make more rapid progress later when the true language interest develops, can be claimed with confidence. Thus, Dewey knew that the new teaching methods would not produce better readers. He assumed that their reading would improve later. Incredible as it may seem, for Dewey, the social goals justified the use of these new reading instruction methods. But why, you might ask, did Dewey consider high literacy to be incompatible with his social goals? He provides the answer. To Dewey, the greatest enemy of socialism was the private consciousness that seeks knowledge in order to exercise its own individual judgment and authority. High literacy gave the individual the means to seek knowledge independently. To Dewey, it created and sustained the individual system, which was detrimental to the social spirit needed to build a socialist society. In Democracy and Education, published in 1916, Dewey devoted a good deal of the book to show how individualism had to adapt itself to the needs of collectivism. He wrote, "When knowledge is regarded as originating and developing within an individual, the ties which bind the mental life of one to that of his fellows are ignored and denied. When the social quality of individualized mental operations is denied, it becomes a problem to find connections which will unite an individual with his fellows. Moral individualism is set up by the conscious separation of different centers of life. It has its roots in the notion that the consciousness of each person is wholly private, a self-enclosed continent, intrinsically dependent of the ideas, wishes, and purposes of everybody else." End of quote. What better way to undermine this independent individualism than by denying it the necessary tool for its development, high literacy? Dewey wrote in School and Society in 1899. "The tragic weakness of the present school is that endeavors to prepare future members of the social order in a medium in which the conditions of the social spirit are eminently wanting. The mere absorbing of facts and truths is so exclusively individual an affair that it tends very naturally to pass into selfishness. There is no obvious social motive for the acquirement of mere learning. There is no clear social gain in success thereat." Some pages later, Dewey wrote, "The introduction of active occupations, of nature society, of elementary science, of art, of history, of the relegation of the merely symbolic and formal to a secondary position, the change in the moral school atmosphere, ellipses, are not mere accidents. They are necessities of the larger social evolution. It remains but to organize all these factors, to appreciate them in their fullness of meaning, and to put ideas and ideals evolved into complete, uncompromising possession of our school system." Note how emphatically Dewey puts it, the relegation of the merely symbolic informal to a secondary position, as well as other curriculum changes, are not mere accidents, but a necessity of the larger social evolution. Dewey based all his new reforms on the new psychology developed at Leipzig and brought to his country by Hall, Cattell, Judd, and others. Okay, let's flesh that out a little better, what was said in that last sentence there. Developed at Leipzig is a reference to German PhDs, mostly people in this case anyway, studying under a man who is considered to be one of the pioneers of the field of psychology, William Wundt. And just so we can tie this to the last video presentation from An Underground History of American Education, you might remember there was a passage that I read from a section of Chapter 7, The Prussian Connection, called Traveler's Reports. And I'm just going to insert that again here. "While German science, philosophy, and military success seduce the whole world, Thousands of prominent young Americans made the pilgrimage to Germany to study in its network of research universities, places where teaching and learning were always subordinate to investigations done on behalf of business and the state. Returning home with the coveted German PhD, those so degreed became university presidents and department heads, took over private industrial research bureaus, government offices, and the administrative professions. The men they subsequently hired for responsibility were those who found it morally agreeable to offer obeisance to the Prussian outlook, too. In this leveraged fashion, the gradual takeover of American mental life managed itself.
The Judd mentioned in that sentence is Charles Hubbard Judd, who was the director of the Department of Education at the University of Chicago. He was an educational psychologist, and he was one of the prime movers behind the Looksay method of reading, which began in the public schools in the 1930s. Incidentally, the Hall mentioned in that sentence was G. Stanley Hall, another pioneering American psychologist and educator who is credited with developing the concept of adolescence, which we've talked about on the show in the past. Also a student of William Wundt at Leipzig in the late 1800s. So back to Trojan Horse, and I'm just going to take that sentence again. Dewey based all his new reforms on the new psychology developed at Leipzig and brought to this country by Hall, Cattell, Judd, and others. He wrote in the same book, "Earlier psychology regarded mind as a purely individual affair, in direct and naked contact with an external world." Ellipses. "At present, the tendency is to conceive individual mind as a function of social life, as not capable of operating or developing by itself, but as requiring continual stimulus from social agencies and finding its nutrition in social supplies. The idea of heredity have made familiar the notion that the equipment of the individual, mental as well as physical, is an inheritance from race, a capital inherited by the individual from the past and held in trust by him for the future. The idea of evolution has made familiar the notion that mind cannot be regarded as an individual, monopolistic possession, but represents the outworkings of the endeavor and thought of humanity." Unquote. Dewey never explained how someone with low literacy skills would be able to enjoy the intellectual inheritance of race if he couldn't read. Although Dewey never minced any words, I think he minced words, the American public has never really been fully aware of Dewey's intense hostility to individualism and what he did in his attempt to destroy it. Max Eastman once wrote that Dewey concealed the dynamite of his educational theories in a pile of dry hay. How true! Perhaps Dewey's view is best summed up in a line he wrote in 1935 in Liberalism in Social Action. Quote, "The last stand of oligarchical and antisocial seclusion is perpetuation of this purely individualistic notion of intelligence." Unquote. Thus, the goal was to produce inferior readers with inferior intelligence, dependent on a socialist educational elite for guidance, wisdom, and control. Dewey knew it, Cattell knew it, and Huey knew it. After the publication of Huey's book in 1908, G. Stanley Hall, Huey's mentor, went so far as to extol the virtues of illiteracy. He wrote, "Very many men have lived and died and been great, even leaders of their age, without any acquaintance with letters. The knowledge which illiterates acquire is probably on the whole more personal, direct, environmental, and probably a much larger proportion of it practical. Moreover, they escape much eye strain and mental excitement and, other things being equal, are probably more active and less sedentary. It is possible, despite the stigma our bepedagogued age puts upon this disability, for those who are under it not only lead a useful, happy, and virtuous life, but to be really well-educated in many other ways. Illiterates escape certain temptations, such as vacuous and vicious reading. Perhaps we are prone to put too high a value upon both the ability required to attain this art and the discipline involved in doing so, as well as the culture value that comes to the citizen with his average of only 6 grades of schooling by the acquisition of this art." Commenting on Huey's book, Hall wrote, "The best pedagogues are now drifting surely, if slowly, toward the conclusion that instead of taking half the time of the first year or two of school to teach reading,
little attention should be paid to it before the beginning of the third year, that nature study, language work, and other things should take the great time and energy now given to this subject. Huey collected nearly 100 primers and classifies reading methods as alphabetic, phonic, phonetic, word, sentence, and combination methods, ellipses. Primary reading should no longer be made a fetich. Fetich, F-E-T-I-C-H, in this case, an object of unreasonably excessive attention or reverence. Continuing reading Hall. This should always be secondary and should have a purpose. That is, there should be no reading for the sake of reading, for this is never an end. It should always be a means of gratifying an interest. I don't totally disagree with that, but I'll move on. When the educational leaders of America, the teachers of our teachers, keep drumming into the heads of their PhD students that the development of literacy in school children is not only not important, but socially undesirable, you get a school system geared to turning out illiterates. It took some years before the views advocated by Dewey, Cattell, Hall, Huey, Thorndike, Judd, and others were translated into practice in every classroom in America. Textbooks had to be written. Teachers had to be trained. The new methods had to be slipped into the schools without undue public notice. After all, parents don't send their children to school to become functionally illiterate. The simple truth is that the NEA played a key and significant role in advancing this conspiracy against literacy. It was a conspiracy because the American people were never informed of what was taking place, nor given a choice. They were never asked if they wanted their children to be taught in a manner that would turn them into functional literates. They were never asked if they wanted their children's education to be tailored for socialist ends. The children were never given a choice between individualistic intelligence and socialist adaptation. All of this was imposed from above by educators, psychologists, and philosophers imbued with a messianic mission to transform America into a socialist society. It would have been hard to impress the parents of America with the virtues of illiteracy. You had to have a PhD to be impressed with that kind of lunacy. In 1922, the NEA launched a monthly magazine for its members, the Journal of the National Education Association. For all practical purposes, it became the house organ of the progressive movement. Cattell, who had been publishing his own weekly magazine, School and Society, since 1915, was especially active in planning the editorial content with the journal's first editor, William C. Bagley of Teachers College, Columbia. Cattell had been expelled from Columbia in 1917 by Nicholas Murray Butler because of his pro-socialist, anti-conscription radicalism. But he continued to be active and highly influential among educators and psychologists until his death in 1944. And this Cattell that Blumenfeld keeps mentioning is Raymond Cattell, a psychologist who in 1937 came to the United States from England. He was invited by Edward Thorndike, who we've mentioned before, from Columbia to take a professorship there. So continuing on, in 1923, Cattell organized the Psychological Corporation, a private company to do psychological consulting and research for education, industry, and government. The stock of the corporation had been sold exclusively to Wundtian and behavioral psychologists. The roster of stockholders was listed in the NEA Journal of June 1923. It included the foremost psychologists of the time. These were the men who transformed every aspect of American education to conform with the theory of evolution and materialism. Now, some people might hear me reading Blumenfeld being critical of people who wanted to bring the theory of evolution into the schools, and you say, whoa, there's more to it than just that. Of course, first of all, like I said, Blumenfeld, not a perfect ally. Also, the theory of evolution at that time came with a lot more than just this idea that we evolve from monkeys. It had a wide range of implications for how human beings should be classified and subsequently treated, as we learned in the series with Thaddeus Russell. And yes, that would move us into things like eugenics. In describing the purpose of the corporation, Cattell wrote, "If everybody were trained and selected for work, there might result a revolution in industry as great as that brought about through the introduction of machinery, ellipses. The scientific control of conduct may become of greater economic importance than the uses of electricity or of steel, ellipses. It is not unreasonable to assume that the production of national wealth would be doubled if everyone, from the feeble-minded child to the president of the nation, were allowed to do the work he can do best and were trained to do it in the best way. Unquote. Now, at this point, when I read that, if somebody is just kind of listening, they might say, oh, yeah, good idea. Have them to do the work they can do best. Well, what is the work? Ask yourself this. What is the work that most young, healthy men can do best? Say 18 to 25. Is it knowledge work in the 19-teens, in the 1920s, in the 1930s? No, it probably involves guns, moving heavy things, putting things together. Probably going to need some people who can do some digging, you know, with the New Deal right around the corner. Probably not a lot of things that produce happiness and self-satisfaction. The work that people can do best. And also, who determines that? Continuing on. Implicit in the scientific control of conduct was a coercive society in which psychologists decided who would be trained for what. It is the system they now use in communist China. This was written again in the early 1980s. As of now, they have not found a better way to produce wealth than the capitalist system, which has made Hong Kong and Taiwan far more productive and wealthy than the People's Republic. Meanwhile, the look-say method had begun to find its way into the schools of America. At first, it was adopted by small, private progressive schools, many of which later dropped it when its negative results became apparent. But its adoption by the public schools on a large scale would have to wait until the 1930s. However, its first use on a large scale in public schools took place in Iowa. It wasn't long before the schools there were plagued by reading problems, in quotes. Indeed, the problems were so serious that they came to the attention of Dr. Samuel T. Orton, a professor of psychiatry at Iowa State University. Orton, a neuropathologist who specialized in speech disorders, was so alarmed by what he saw that he wrote an article entitled The Sight Reading Method of Teaching Reading as a Source of Reading Disability, which was published in the February 1929 issue of the Journal of Educational Psychology. Orton was almost apologetic in the way he approached the subject, for Harold Rugg, an associate of Dewey and Thorndike, edited the journal, and Arthur Gates, Thorndike's protege, was on its editorial board. Perhaps they published it because it confirmed their theory that the new teaching method would destroy the high literacy they wanted to get rid of. Orton wrote, "I feel some trepidation in offering criticism in a field somewhat outside of my own endeavor, but a very considerable part of my attention for the past 4 years has been given to the study of reading disability from the standpoint of cerebral physiology. This work has now extended over a comparatively large series of cases from many different schools, and both the theory which has directed this work and the observations garnered therefrom seem to bear with sufficient directness on certain teaching methods in reading to warrant critical suggestions which otherwise might be considered overbold. I wish to emphasize at the beginning that the strictures which I have to offer here do not apply to the use of the sight method of teaching reading as a whole, but to its effects on a restricted group of children for whom, as I think we can show, this technique is not only not adapted, but often proves an actual obstacle to reading progress. And moreover, I believe this group is one of considerable size, and because here, faulty teaching methods may not only prevent the acquisition of academic education by children of average capacity, but may also give rise to far-reaching damage to their emotional life." Unquote. This was the first article in which a trained neuropathologist stated in no uncertain terms that, quote, the sight method of teaching reading could cause reading disability to be, quote, an obstacle to reading progress rather than a help. He also made it clear that these faulty teaching methods may not only prevent the acquisition of academic education by children of average capacity, but may also give rise to far-reaching damage to their emotional life. The case against Look Say could not have been spelled out more clearly and in more alarming terms, but the NEA Journal said nothing. In fact, it devoted its December 1929 issue to a celebration of John Dewey's 70th birthday, awarding America's premier social philosopher educator with a life membership. The magazine was filled with tributes from countless university presidents and other notables. It left the reader with no doubt as to who stood beside Horace Mann on the pedestal of public education. It also indicated to what extent the progressives now had complete control of American public education. It was hardly to be expected that one article in a professional journal owned and operated by the progressives would deter them from their plans to socialize America.
So if you're a listener of either one of our programs, this is where we combine. We're going to try to do this about once a month, right, Brett?
Yeah, I was thinking the first Monday of every month we could, you know, get together and we could talk about what's happened on our shows.
I think
And
good.
Even if no one calls and if no one chats, you know, we have each other.
It sounds terrific. And there's so many things that I'm interested in discussing. And I know that we had a number of things we wanted to discuss last week. But there are a lot more questions I'd like to explore with you, Brett, because you have been able to take some stories and go way beyond to talk about things that have to do with philosophy, empiricism, all sorts of interesting stuff. Your most recent production, actually in multiple parts, about the non-aggression principle, the idea of objective morality versus subjective morality, a lot of things that I know a lot of people have been talking about on your website and on your Facebook page, right?
Yeah, where that series wound up, and you're speaking about this history series that we did with Thaddeus Russell, the author of A Renegade History of the United States, which we just concluded after 10 episodes with a pretty lively debate. When I say we kind of tripped into this, there were a lot of things about Thad that we didn't know. When we started the series, we didn't really know where he stood on a lot of philosophical issues. We really didn't know what his knowledge of or what his opinion was about libertarianism. Mm. And
he'd just drop it in. Like, we'd be in the middle of talking about, you know, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, and he'd say, and of course, there is no truth. And then he'd move on to the next sentence, right?
Okay. Like, wait, hold back up.
Yes. So you did an entire 2 episodes kind of going back and collecting all those little tidbits.
Yeah,
that he had dropped over the course of over a year.
Well, right? You know, another thing that we want to talk about, you know, we're all podcasters.
Yeah,
we need to think
true.
Of a name for this show, too. We can't just call it The School Sucks Liberty Conspiracy. I was thinking we call it Podcast Masters. But you say podcast really fast. Podcast Masters.
Podcast Masters.
Almost like PD apostrophe cast masters.
You just leave the pod off.
Cast Masters.
Cast Masters.
Cast Masters.
How
is
about
good.
Liberty yeah. Mastercast?
Yeah.
That's okay, but it reminds me of the plaster casters from the late 60s. Mickey Dolenz was one of them, so that's always good. John Lennon, Jim Morrison.
Sure. Liberty Masterclass. There's another
Liberty
one.
Liberty Masterclass. I like all that stuff. That sounds good.
So we will need a name, but what I was saying is this would also be a good opportunity to talk about, you know, some of the decisions that we make on the show, because I think
different approaches and what we try to include or not include, and especially because I know you handle certain things, I don't go in certain directions. In fact, that's part of my modus operandi.
People should know that this is a bit of a craft, right?
Yes, not witchcraft, but some other kind of craft. Yeah.
And Osborne, you said you found all the Thaddeus discussions fascinating.
Totally
right?
Fascinating. Most fascinating guest ever on School Sucks.
Yeah. Absolutely great. Fantastic.
So should we just be mining this man for his historical knowledge, or should we be pressing him on these things that are going to divert us from our primary purpose and also possibly be areas where he doesn't really know that much?
I think you do both, you know, why not? And then I think you've done it properly. You mine for information, you soak up stuff that's interesting to you and hopefully interesting to the listeners.
Right.
They take it with them wherever they are, on a plane, in a car, fighting Ebola, whatever. And then if there are points that people bring up, then you come in after the fact. I love it. It's great.
When I started doing shows with him, I knew he would be controversial because I hadn't read the whole book, Renegade History, but I had read enough of it to know that it would be it would generate a lot of conversation.
Yeah.
And that was one of the reasons why I wanted to have him on the show, because I wanted more listener participation. I didn't mean to make anybody upset. I didn't mean to lose listeners over it. But I wasn't expecting what we ultimately got. You know, in the end, it was like a lot of people were angry. A lot of people, you should have done this, you should have done that. But I think it is a net benefit. I think he added a lot of value to the show, not just in increasing listener participation, but also in getting people to think, you know?
Yeah.
Libertarianism generally can be kind of dogmatic. And I catch myself, like, something happens in the news and I say, oh, I know what this is.
That's absolutely right. We become, and in fact, I find myself reflexively empirical and deductive rather than sometimes inductive.
Right.
And,
yeah.
And I think it requires both. And I think you even mentioned in one of the podcasts, it requires inductive reasoning and deductive reasoning.
Right.
Something we should mention as we're going into our first ad set so we can hear from the folks backing us up. I should mention, if people aren't familiar with Thaddeus's work because maybe they're only listening to the Liberty Conspiracy stuff, shame on you. We ought to mention a little bit more about who he is, what he's done, and how they can find your podcast, Brett, and your website. Sound
absolutely
good?
Yeah. SchoolSucksProject.com. We can talk about that more.
Okay. We'll return. Liberty Conspiracy Radio on LRN.FM. We return to Liberty Conspiracy Radio on the Liberty Radio Network, and it is a combination of Liberty Conspiracy and the School Sucks Project tonight. Gardner
Indeed.
Goldsmith and Brett, good to have you here, man.
And, of course, Osborne.
Hey, Jason guys. Osborne. Hey, man.
What's that bumper song right there?
That song is actually a really, really obscure tune, and I'm glad you brought it up. The band Human Sexual Response, the guitarist from Human Sexual Response, is a guy named Rich Gilbert. He formed a band along with the remaining members of the Human Sexual Response that remained in Boston called the Zulus. Then he formed a splinter band while the Zulus were huge in Boston called the Concussion Ensemble. It was composed of about 10 people. They had 3 or 4 drummers, 2 bassists, 2 guitarists, and they were all members of different bands from Boston. The Zulus, The Five, Slaughter Shack, all sorts of people. Like Joey Santiago from the Pixies sat in with them sometimes, and that's a song called Cleopatra 94, and they have one disc. It's really hard to find, but you can actually see some of their stuff on YouTube. I think they're called, it's not even listed under Concussion Ensemble. I think it's like CE. If you look up Concussion Ensemble Boston, you'll find a live version of that song. It's a great one. It's really good.
Nice.
Yeah, and of course, Rich Gilbert went on to play with Frank Black and has done all sorts of stuff. He even worked on the Powerpuff Girls record with Frank Black. So there you go. Anyway, thank you for the question. And let's one guy's good work get promoted a little bit more. So he's talented.
So here's a question I thought of for you today.
Yes, sir.
Since we're still talking, we're still kind of feeling out the combining of the shows.
Yes,
okay.
Yes, definitely.
Sam Blumenfeld, still alive?
Oh, Sam, as far as I know, in fact, I've been thinking about him the past few days. It's sort of interesting that you should bring him up because, of course, Sam and John Taylor Gatto, hand in hand, have for me it was Sam, and for so many other people it was John Taylor Gatto. Sam was sort of about 10 years ahead of Gatto.
Yeah.
And actually a real long time ago in the late 60s he started writing about government education. And Sam lives in northern Massachusetts. He's a great guy. He gave me all the copies he had of the Freeman magazine a while back last year, but I haven't spoken to him. But I would love to get him on and speak to him. And actually what you've been doing with John Taylor Gatto's underground history of American education, I would love to do with some of his books. Turning them into audiobooks would just be amazing.
Yeah, that was one of the reasons why I asked. I know you had had him on your show in the past. By the way, if people have any thoughts on this topic, Blumenfeld or Gatto, we do the John Taylor Gatto video series at School Sucks. We are now streaming live at schoolsucksproject.com/live. In addition to being on LRN.FM, you can join a chat there. And if you want to participate directly in this conversation with us, you can Skype in.
Yes.
Gardner.Goldsmith.
Yep. GARDNER.Goldsmith. If you want your voice to come through, if you want to type in a message, feel free. And of course, those other venues also have their chat boxes open, correct?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yes. Great.
So as far as Gatto and Blumenfeld, it seems like, especially from the work that you did with Blumenfeld, he focused more on what happened at the turn of the 20th century, right?
Yeah.
With the progressives. And Gatto, Gatto deals with all that. Gatto goes through, right up into like the 1950s in this huge book, The Underground History of American Education.
Yeah.
So recently I've been working through the Prussian connection.
Yes.
So I'm finding what a lot of people had to say wasn't really as malevolent as I initially thought. It seems like there was a lot of people who were at least trying to do the right thing based on the information that they had at the time. Are you familiar with a guy named Johann Pestalozzi?
Yes. And okay. It's funny you should bring it up because Blumenfeld, in Blumenfeld's work, just to backtrack a little bit, he actually goes back to the 1600s in the United States.
Yeah.
And he talks about the Unitarians in Massachusetts and how interested they were in starting government education, but they couldn't get a foothold. It just couldn't do it because the vast majority of the people were educated privately in Boston. And there was just no market for the government to start to do it. They couldn't convince people, hey, get the government to do this. And it took them a long, long time. And then in the late 19th century, you started to see a real strong push, especially from the Protestants who didn't want the Catholics going to their Catholic church-based schools. They wanted to incorporate them into what they thought was a more noble thing, which was to have them be part of the society that they saw as an American society, sort of like Noah Webster's dictionary, to create a unique American culture.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
I think that that has a lot to do with that idea of bringing in this sort of uniformity in education through the Prussian system. I don't know; I could be wrong, but.
Well, I was just, you know, I found this, there's this fantastic resource that everyone should check out called Internet Archive. Have you guys ever used that?
No.
Okay, so Gatto in this book, he has a lot of references. Like, he mentions the work of, so this person, that person, and all these books, these obscure books that were written in the 19th century or maybe in the early 20th century. But you can't find them anywhere, you know? Suddenly, I stumble across this thing called Internet Archive. Every single one of these books is there in full text.
Wow.
You can flip through it. So now you can see everything.
Talk about going to original sources.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And that's super valuable. In the video I just made, I was actually taking screenshots of me flipping through the book. You can't see me all gleefully flipping.
But you can see the pages.
You can see the pages turn in the book, which is amazing because we've talked about these books kind of in this abstract for so long, all these resources, all this original intent.
Yeah.
But that's just kind of like in the distance, and,
right.
and now to actually like see these books, and I made these little like blurbs pop out like this.
Oh, nice.
You know, this person said this, but
so
go ahead.
After examining these works,
yeah.
do you feel Gatto is now vindicated from some of these claims against him that he cites these sources, but you can't verify them?
Yeah, great,
so
great point.
So
that's a good question. I feel like he is in a way. But I also think that he's looking back from, I don't want to like psychologize him and say he was jaded by his 30-year experience in the New York public schools, but he saw what school had become,
right,
you know?
Right.
And maybe you can't look from 1820 forward and say, oh gosh, this is going to be
awful.
You're
at the destination looking back, and so it's obviously colored by what you're experiencing at the destination.
Yeah, you're kind of standing in hell looking back at the road that was paved with good intentions.
Right.
Because I don't really, you know, the way that he initially talks about this, just in a cursory examination of what Gatto does, you would think that these people were evil, you know? And that's kind of how they're portrayed in some of his shorter books where he skims across these histories a little bit more than he does in the underground history.
Yeah.
So the presentation of these people in the book is definitely affected by his attitude toward the public school, but the people are saying what he says they're saying. He seems like he misquotes a lot. Like he gets the gist of the quote is right, but it's not word for word, and I wonder why that happens.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
I'll comment a little bit because Sam Blumenfeld and his material in his books, especially Is Public Education Necessary? And he goes back to some of the very, very early source materials from the Unitarian Church, but also later in the early 20th century. We'll continue talking about this. Gardner and
Brett
and Osborne
here at Liberty Conspiracy / School Sucks Project.
Welcome back to Podcast Masters.
I like that.
No?
Try it again.
I was waiting for the drop and I totally missed it. I thought it was sooner. I'm sorry.
It's all right.
All right. So if you're just joining us, I'm Brett Bonnott. I'm the host of School Sucks Podcast. Also from School Sucks Podcast, Jason Osborne in the studio as well.
Hello.
And Gardner Goldsmith from Liberty Conspiracy.
Hello.
This is his slot. These are his wonderful bumpers that you're hearing.
Yes.
And we're trying out a new thing where once a month we combine our two shows for a live, theoretically, call-in listener participation live show.
Yep.
I love talking to listeners.
Me too. I would love that very much. And Osborne is going to be my backbone here. If I can't say anything, he's going to pretend he's me. So
I know.
If I sound
stupid,
I cannot
think of two gentlemen I would more like to get in a room together to orally pleasure the listener.
Yeah, we're doing our best.
Yes, work very, very hard. Yes, on the phallic microphones. So listen, it's great to be here. Remember, everybody, if you want to contact us, we have multiple ways to contact us. You can reach me on Skype at gardner.goldsmith on Skype. Type a question or call us verbally if you want to. And also, we're on Ustream and let's see, where else are we? Oh, it's at the School Sucks Project as well. Can they get into the chat room over there?
Yep, that's where the chat room is,
schoolsucksproject.com/live.
There's people chatting. There's people interacting with each other.
they can, as time goes by, this is the great thing about Ustream, as time goes by, they can stop paying attention to us altogether, they just enjoy their new friends that they've made in the chat.
Yes.
So before we went to break, we were talking about John Taylor Gatto and Samuel Blumenfeld, two, I would say, two of the best known education critics to come along in the last 50 years. There's certainly a couple others, but each of their bodies of work, very significant in, you know, shedding light on the intentions behind the school system and the different people who tried to grab it and control it.
Yeah.
Obviously, it shouldn't even be controversial at this point to say when people saw the power of an institution like this, if they had some kind of political, social, economic, philosophical agenda, they knew that this was a goose that just lays endless golden eggs. So the fact that it's even considered to be kind of a wacky conspiracy that people tried to use the school system to mold children to their own ends, I think we should move beyond that. And like we were talking about with this wonderful Internet Archive that I invite everyone to check out.
Yeah, I love that idea.
It's all out there now. You know, you can see all these documents written by people who didn't think, you know, I mean, people were writing books in the early 1970s that they didn't think most people would ever get to see.
One of the fascinating things that Sam did, and he clued me into this just in conversation very early on, was he said, you know, Gard, I went into the archives of the transcripts of the meetings of the National Teachers Union, the NEA. He said, that's where you find statements from these people saying, for example, when they talk about the look-say method or whole language method of reading, sight word reading rather than phonetics, sounding out syllables and the root phonemes and so on. He says, you know, there were people in the 1940s when this was initiated in various school systems and in the 1950s when they would have meetings about these things on a national level who believed that the intelligent kids would be able to figure out how to read and the other kids might have a hard time, but it was useful to have some kids who could have a hard time reading. So he shows in his books some of the citations of these people actually saying, well, we're going to need blue-collar workers.
Yeah.
It's a good thing. So they really did, and to go back to your original point a couple segments ago, as you go back into the source materials, you find that their motives were not nefarious or malicious motives. They had, much like the early eugenicists, had a noble goal. It just so happens that in order to achieve their noble goal, as they saw it, a noble goal, as they saw it, they had to do things to people through government systems.
Yeah. And it just kind of like it's a balancing act, right? You can't have too many too smart people. You can't have too many too dumb people.
They had to manage society.
Yeah. It's just
and,
the scales.
And who else? Who better but the people who could, as you say, get control of the education system to help produce what they saw as the noble goal?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's the same. It goes all the way back to the noble lie, you know, in Plato. You know, it's like, well, some people have gold and some people don't have that precious metal mixed in with them. They just don't have it. So the gold people will rule and they'll know best.
Yeah.
It's the same thing. It's the same sort of noble lie, except executed through government policy. And it's amazing when you tell some people about this, like as I've mentioned, you know, I'll talk to parents whose children are diagnosed dyslexic or something like that. And I'll say, well, were they taught phonics? And they don't even know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
And then I'll say, you know, this was something that they intended to do. They made this a concerted, systematic, methodological effort on the part of the school systems. They pushed for this.
Yeah. And it came from Prussia, the look-say method. And this was really where I think a lot of the attempts to organize society into, you know, smart, medium and dumb.
Yes, yes.
Basically, it happened. You know, I talked about this in the last video that I just put out. They had something. I'm going to butcher the pronunciation of this and get letters, but Akademienschulen, which was at the very top for the elite, it was private.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was the Realschulen, which was, I mean, basically translates
the real school.
The real school. So you're talking at the academy level, the private level, as we're going back to Prussia, you're talking 1 or 2% of the population.
Mm.
And these are the masters.
Yeah.
And then, you know, 5 to 7, 5 to 8% of the population in the Realschulen or Schulen. I feel like that S needs a little more pizzazz.
I'm glad you like that. This is radio. You sound terrific.
And that's, you know, 5 to 8% of the population, and those are the managers. Those are the administrators of society. And whatever you have left, 93% attended the Volksschule, the people's place or people's school, and they were the scientifically managed.
I've always held my opinion about people is generally most people are pretty bright.
Sure. Or capable.
Exactly. Yeah. And it just is unfortunate that in some cases, either they are allowed to become lazy or that innate intelligence is crushed for whatever reason, that their inquisitiveness is crushed or whatever it might be. And, you know, I often say I had a friend at 9 years old who was reading the Auto Mechanics Bible. Now, a lot of people might look at it as an auto mechanic, blue collar worker guy as being somehow less intelligent than a doctor. But, you know, I tell you what, I wasn't reading the Auto Mechanics Bible at nine, and neither was my sister. She's a doctor, you know.
They're billing out at close to the same rates.
Yes, exactly. And when you think about it.
When you normalize for the educational requirements.
They're doing better. Yeah. Absolutely.
It's an interesting dichotomy, this notion of having to make sure we have the smart people and the dumb people because, you can't have too many smart people, right?
Yeah.
So these are the same people who would push this message of equality, right?
That's a great point.
And yet this educational structure is precisely what creates the inequality.
And we're talking a little bit about education in the United States. John Taylor Gatto's seminal book, Underground History of American Education. And Brett has been doing a number of videos about this. You can find those on YouTube, the School Sucks Project videos, and as well as other great presentations that he has put together. Amazing things. I mean, so many views. It's just remarkable, Brett. Really good stuff.
Well, including one with the three of us, where we talk about Glenn Greenwald and Larry O'Donnell.
Yes, and did the communists actually win the Cold War?
That actually never made it out.
Oh, that was a very interesting conversation. I enjoyed that. But that Glenn Greenwald stuff was great.
That was a fun night.
Is that an episode receptive in The Secret Stash?
There's a Red Scare talk in The Secret Stash, and the Glenn Greenwald show's got a good 12,000 views.
Fantastic. So. That's fantastic. Well,
so maybe if the listeners go to schoolsucksproject.com and sign up to be in the AV club, they can listen to this treasured episode.
Absolutely.
That they wouldn't otherwise be able to hear.
Oh my goodness, they could hear so much.
So they have to sign up for the AV club.
The AV club.
All right,
that's how we support the show.
That's a good thing. I just think it's great. And I think the idea of the AV club is terrific. And of course, with the Liberty Conspiracy, we've been doing a lot of things to try to expand and get more people to be aware of what we're doing. And we often stress that we're not a conspiratorial group. We're not into conspiracy theories. But to go back to the subject you were discussing in the last couple segments, Brett, Jason was making a few points about the Prussian model of education, the cadres, as you were bringing up, the idea of the elites, the semi-elite, the workers, and you know so on. And this is the sort of thing that a lot of people don't believe, that in American education history, there could have been people who thought that this was noble to try to push. And Jason, you were just bringing up the fact that these are often the same people who talk about equality.
Oh, yeah. They want equality, but then they create these classes of people through the educational system where you have the smart people and the dumb people.
You think that's an egalitarian sort of concept because they're the smart ones, so they'll make sure that all the others are taken care of in their place.
And you hear the same kind of bad economic thinking when people talk about immigration.
So true.
Right? Like, well, if we don't have the immigrants, then there will be no one to do these jobs.
Yeah.
Like, no, the jobs will get done. It's just the price will get bid up, and relatively the price for other jobs will get bid down.
Yeah.
So if we all had access to the same education, then doctors would cost a lot less and picking up your trash would cost a lot more and we would be more equal.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But and what this was really about, and you touched on, we've all touched on it at this point, was getting people to basically accept their station in life. And that was the only criticism from this educational theorist and like early psychologist Johann Pestalozzi, is that he worked mostly with the poor in Germany. And the Americans who went to see his schools were saying, this is really great. He just makes them happy. You know, Gatto writes in the book, he gave them love in place of ambition, you know, and people accepted their station. So as they were trying to create a society that could be manageable, and it's all different things at all different times. In the Prussian era, it's mostly military. And then when it shifts to the United States, it first has to do with creating a religious homogeny, then it shifts to the industrial, and then it shifts to the progressives. And then you even have this kind of weird overlap where you have like the Rockefellers funding progressives like John Dewey
yes.
at Columbia University.
Yeah, huge.
And that's weird.
Yeah, very, very strange. And they've been, I don't want to get all conspiratorial about this. But
get all conspiratorial. Yeah,
it is fascinating to see how so many of some of the wealthiest families out there have gotten involved with this top-down control thing. And it is very egalitarian.
And it's completely predictable, right?
Because
they want to protect their wealth by creating barriers toward crossing
entry.
Into it.
Very good point. Yes.
I want to say one thing about conspiracy, though, right? So I'm on the internet today, and Sandy Hook comes across my news feed somehow.
Yes, yes.
These things happen.
Yeah.
And I say, ooh, Sandy Hook.
Uh-huh.
Now, I'm the kind of guy, you might not be conspiratorial, you might not be Osborne, but if you say to me, here's how I know we never went to the moon, you just bought an hour of my attention.
I'm the same way. I'll watch the videos of these people because I want to see where their arguments are strong or where they're weak, and I want to say to myself, what do I know or what do I not know?
Right.
Is there something I don't know?
The reason why I decided that it was so important to focus on the school piece, they could, let's say the government did perpetrate all kinds of false flag attacks and, you know, like Sandy Hooks and 9/11, and it's all fake, let's just say, for the sake of argument.
Yeah.
All they have to do is tell people that it isn't, right? And if people don't have the intellectual self-defense and they don't have the emotional or intellectual strength to look at these things more closely, they're just going to buy whatever official stories always are. And people are very into official stories about even things that we think are not true, you know, as far as economics are concerned. Like, who are the trusted name in economics? What are the trusted names in news? What are the trusted names in political science? It's nobody good.
Absolutely.
Know? But if people don't have the ability to defend themselves, from these stories and from that propaganda, it's all pointless. Like, you could invest 200 hours, let's just say, in Sandy Hook research. And who are you going to run to with all that?
Right.
Nobody's listening.
Yeah.
So I thought that if we really want to change the world in meaningful ways, the best foot forward was the school piece, right? And getting people to understand where school came from. Now, I rejected it at first, too. I stumbled across this stuff when I was in graduate school.
Yeah.
And I was like in the early stages of research, and I came across Gatto.
Yep.
And I was like, school is a conspiracy to make people dumb and control them.
Yep. Yeah.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
And then I kind of moved on, and eventually I just came back to it. But I really thought that the best way to reach people, not just to make them more aware and to sharpen their defenses, but also hopefully to get them to embrace, voluntarism, was through this school doorway.
I think it's a terrific way to do it also because you can show them the history.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can, it's one thing to make a claim. It's another thing to make a claim and then document it.
Mm-hmm.
And if someone is empirically minded, if someone is interested in the documentation, they'll say, wow, hey, this guy's got a pretty strong argument here. Look at all these citations. Oh, look at the curve of history. Look at how this went. And to me, just that endeavor is a noble endeavor unto itself.
Yeah.
You know, I think trying to discover the truth is extremely important, even though, of course, as you guys discussed in one of your most recent podcasts, truth is sometimes a malleable concept.
Oh, we can talk about that in hour two.
We are here at your service, my friends, and you can contact us on Skype if you are so inclined. It is Gardner, G-A-R-D-N-E-R .Goldsmith on Skype and on Ustream.
SchoolSucksProject.com. You can go and join a chat. I'm looking at the chat right now. People are getting along nicely.
Very good. We like this.
Yeah.
A symbiosis.
Yeah, absolutely.
Excellent, excellent. And I know that Nathan has tried to contact us on Skype. Nathan, thank you very much for doing so. Last hour we talked, opened up discussion about education in America and your work on the video series covering John Taylor Gatto's Underground History. And I also mentioned something that I found very interesting about the most recent School Sucks Project podcasts, which have just been absolutely fascinating. And Osborne, you mentioned that just terrific, terrific conversations. If you can tell people a little bit more about that, Brett, and where they can find these, that would be awesome. Again, my audience, oftentimes I look at the breaking stories, try to pick those apart, look at the Constitution, then try to go beyond that into the theoretical. And you had a great series about philosophy, objective reality, the non-aggression principle. You were speaking with Thaddeus.
Yeah, and the series was meant to be none of that.
Wow. Right?
I didn't think we were going to get into that at all.
Yeah.
And then, as Osborne said, he started dropping. Droppings would be a good word for
a lot of historical things, or his. How would you describe it?
Yeah, a typical historian talk, right? Because from their point of view, right, they're looking at all these old documents, right?
Yeah.
And so there's no reality to be found in that. You're reading what someone wrote down on paper.
Yes, absolutely.
Right?
Absolutely.
You can't go back in time and use your senses to observe the actual happenings from back then.
Yeah.
So you kind of, you're required to take the point of view that that he was espousing on the show, which is, yeah, there's no truth. There's what people said, and we try to tell a story about it.
Yeah, that's actually a good point, because when you come to philosophy through a historian's lens, it's like, yeah, I mean, what did Napoleon say? It's basically just a lie that we agree upon.
That's a great, great line, unfortunately.
And the way I described it, I'm sorry for my audience, because I'm being very repetitive here, but I think it's a good analogy. We like movies, right? And we go to the movies, and I like to get behind the scenes of the movies a little
how
bit.
How it was made and script writing.
Yeah, absolutely. Because, I mean, movies are an art, but it's also, you know, a technology. You know,
absolutely.
And that's like a very cool combination.
Yes.
And I guess you could say that about like podcasting or making videos, but movies is like a lot goes into that.
Absolutely.
And I love to get behind the scenes. I love to get into the work of, you know, a new director and see all their films and see the things they did. I was when I discovered Christopher Nolan.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and he only had like two movies then, but I watched them both and I said, I see what he's doing. He's good.
Yeah, he is
good. Scorsese, my all-time favorite. We talk about him on my show.
Steve Pizzillo of American Cinematographer Magazine. He's the executive editor. He's got a book of about Scorsese coming out soon. So I'll let you know about that. Yeah.
Yeah. So we look at history like a scene in a movie. Now, if you're the director or the historian, you have all these different options for how the story can be told. You can put the camera up high, you know. You can put the camera down low. You can be in close. You could be far away. You can make things disappear by turning the lights down. You can bring things into an uncomfortable visibility by turning the light up.
Yeah.
And it seems like historians have a lot of the same choices. You know what I mean?
It's the same thing. Sorry to interrupt, but it's the same thing that I noticed with news reporters when I was a teenager.
Mm-hmm.
By the selection of their stories, the order of the stories, especially in national television news, the way the people they interview, the people they don't interview, the number of days into a particular topic that they will continue to cover that topic, all of those editorial decisions all color how the message is going to be perceived.
Absolutely.
And it is done absolutely just like a film director works with a cinematographer and an editor. Absolutely right. And the historian does the same thing. What does the historian cite? How does he put the chapters together? How does he build it? What's the coloring of his wording?
Yeah. And we can give some more specific examples too. There are historical lenses. So since we're talking about Thaddeus Russell, what he really does is he tries to look at history through a cultural lens. How did, in many cases, pop culture change the course of history?
Mm.
Right? Now, he is told that this is an unacceptable thing to do. You're either supposed to deal with history through a trends and forces lens, which I'd say, you know, people like Howard Zinn did, right? Dealing mostly with trends from the bottom up.
Yeah.
We have a favorite historian, though. Her name is Doris Kearns Goodwin. She is a wonderful woman. She tells the most heartwarming stories about some of America's best murderers, like Abraham Lincoln and
Teddy
Lyndon
Roosevelt,
Johnson.
FDR, Lyndon Johnson. Oh,
yeah. So she's written these books where she just valorizes and lionizes these.
Absolutely.
I don't want to call them terrible people. I don't know enough about Abraham Lincoln to say that he was just a terrible man.
Yeah.
The impact on government that he had, whether he knew it or he was going to have it or not,
was not positive.
I think, but I think you're right. She lionizes these people and she whitewashes a lot of their history, excluding things that would be important to give people some understanding of the other side of their policies or their personalities, and including anecdotes that are just these cute, colorful anecdotes that make them much more human.
Yeah.
To me, that excludes a lot of very important information that can be important to people now to say, maybe I shouldn't look at these politicians so blithely.
Right.
And, you know, I was just going to mention, Osborne, you talked about the idea of truth. And you're talking about the historian, you know, obviously I'm reminded of that quote from The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. And I think I posted it when I made the link. I posted the link on Facebook to your most recent podcast. And I said, it's like the end of The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy radio series, where Ford Prefect finds out that Zaphod, a weird guy out in a shack who supposedly runs the galaxy. He doesn't even believe there's a reality. This old guy, you know, he doesn't even believe that people come to him and they ask him questions about such and such should happen. What do you think? And he's like, I don't even know these people exist. He's a purely subjective Kantian figure, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so they're like, how can you say these things to these people and give them suggestions about how to run the galaxy? He goes, I don't know them. I don't know who they are. They might not even exist. I'm just giving them my opinion. And they're like, don't you understand that your opinion affects billions of people? He goes, I don't know those people. I don't know if they're real. I just say what I think. So Ford Prefect says to Zaphod Riebelbrox at the end, some terrible thing that Zaphod did. He goes, how could you have done it? He goes, you know, you heard the weirdo. What's real? Or what's he says, was that true, Zaphod, that you did that? Was that true? He goes, you heard the weirdo. What's truth? And it makes me think about how truth is subjective because we are all subjective creatures.
It seems like a philosophical escape hatch to me.
I agree.
You can just get into a big argument about something and then be like, all right, goodbye.
That's absolutely right. It's this unfortunate tautology, because eventually it gets into an infinite regress. Because if you're talking about, even if you say, look, for example, in your podcast, you mentioned, well, you know, we're all looking to promote liberty and freedom. We think that that is good. But every one of those terms can be subjectively defined.
Right.
And then if you say, well, I believe that there is a truism that people are subjective, then someone will, you know, come up, some smart aleck will say, well, that's a tautology right there, because how can you say that it's true that everybody's subjective? Because nothing is true.
Mm-hmm.
And you're just like, okay, look, we're going to have to, in order to facilitate some sort of argument, we're going to have to understand that at the core of this, there's a non-escape problem. There's a non-escape clause here. You know, we can't escape the fact that we're going to run into a tautology if we're trying to observe human behavior and say that we're actually observing human behavior, because someone will say, well, there aren't any humans to actually observe. How can you say that? So you have to come up with some basic understanding when you're talking truth or history or how it's perceived. Anyway, that's a little more philosophical. We'll return. And it's good to have everybody here. We are doing a live Ustream broadcast as well as the Liberty Conspiracy radio broadcast on LRN.FM. I hope you don't mind, Brett and Jason, but I did want to sort of get into that philosophical side of it just a little bit more, because I was so intrigued by this series of shows that you produced, Brett, for the School Sucks Project, as you were speaking with Thaddeus Russell. And I just thought it was absolutely fascinating talking about the non-aggression principle, objective reality, and objective morality, which is what we were discussing to the live stream audience during the commercial break. So folks listening at LRN, sorry you missed a little bit, but just to sort of recap, why don't you explain to some of our listeners, if you can, I don't want to put you on the spot, and Jason, you can chime in too, please, what the conversation started to deal with Thaddeus about objective reality, but also objective morality and the idea of subjective morals. And because I can recap very quickly if you want me to now, but I can wait until you do the introduction to sort of get people familiar if you want to.
Do you think there's a distinction between using the word universal as opposed to objective with regard to morality?
I think there absolutely is.
So,
yeah.
That's a great point.
Yeah, and I think that was one of Thad's objections, is that he didn't like things being universalized. He saw there was this kind of evil, and he had these historical examples. Like, because he didn't know that much about objectivism, all he had was these historical examples of when people, like the people we talked about in our education discussion, tried to universalize things, tried to make these universal claims and apply them to all people as a, you know, a means of scientific management.
Right.
And he's very against science, it seems. Like, yeah. Which I get, like, well, Paul Krugman claims to do science, right?
Well, yeah.
I
can understand it, Jason, however, but I can think about it in this way. I could say, look, I understand a person who says that there is no objective truth because we're all subjective, saying something to that effect, which is science is trying to apply, or a scientist who tries to say that this is true is trying to apply it in a certain way. But you don't have to look at it that way. You can just have every piece of data, every datum is an anecdote.
Mm-hmm.
So if you look at it that way, you can say, well, look, I believe that this is shown at this time, but it could be different next time. You know, it could be that radiation doesn't radiate in that way in the future. But based on trial and error, the outside world seems to operate this way according to how I perceive it. He was very much into the, well, you can only say what you perceive.
Yeah.
And you shouldn't try to tell anybody else how to perceive things. Right? Is that?
Yeah, yeah. Well, the very nature of science is such that it doesn't actually look for truth, right? It only has ideas that have not yet been falsified.
Yeah, right? Absolutely. Right. Right.
So it's always evolving. And then he thought that there was this kind of what is really we could call scientism. If you hear somebody say something like the debate is over, watch out.
Yes.
Right.
Yes. Yes. But do you think that he even thought that the debate itself was trending towards trying to tell people the debate is over? Because that's sort of the fear that I got that sense that he actually was. Slightly askance at the idea of scientists exploring these things because the end result would be we've achieved some truth here.
For me, my read on it was a kind of jaded outlook that was similar to what I described about Gatto.
Yeah,
it's like here's a guy who sees what's been done. And he's like, stop sounding like them. I don't like it when you guys talk like that.
But at the same time, too, he falls back upon it when it's convenient for him. Like, I listened to the Joe Rogan show that he did, which was a great show.
He was great, yeah.
But he said the words, all historians agree on this, and this is not controversial.
Yes, yes.
Like 24 times
right
during that show. So he'll...
That's a prime defense mechanism right there. That's absolutely right.
So
yeah,
it's what I see that is like as somebody who presents things. The reason why I say that, and then I'll let you go on. I'd say that if I was trying to rush through something, right? Like if I'm trying to make a point, like Thad, like me, gets excited about his points. You know, like I have points I want to make. I'm excited about them. Let's keep the conversation moving, other participants.
I see what you're saying. So there are certain things that are that let's just say for the sake we all assume X, Y, or Z so I can get to, you know, X plus Y.
Yeah. So you don't want to get hung up on something along the way, even if it's like juicy and potentially, leading into a broader conversation or, you know, even risking derailing the track that he wants to go down. He would just say, yeah, I know that's weird, but everyone agrees. So it's kind of it's a rhetorical tactic more than anything, I think. I don't think he was doing it to try to be tricky.
Well, I'll give you an example.
But he does do it a lot.
Yeah, yeah. It's one of the things that I thought was interesting was actually, you know what, I'm going to hold off on that because you started talking about the non-aggression principle and whether or not it would be moral or acceptable to go after a Walmart and attack a Walmart because it was a corporate creation. Some of the facts that were brought up there were actually incorrect. Like, they get all this land from the governments and things. It's actually the vast majority of Walmart's people try to block from going into their areas because the local merchants don't want them. And it happens over and over and over again. They try to stop that.
Including local governments.
Absolutely right. And if certain merchants have a lot of sway in the local advisory boards or something, then Walmart. In Nashua, this happened twice. They haven't put a Walmart in Nashua, even though Walmart's tried twice in Nashua, New Hampshire. But I think it's interesting because when I think this is this sort of concept where he'll bring up something, that's one of the reasons why you went back, because he would bring up certain things like, well, this and this and this historically. And you say, well, wait a minute. And you went back and you started to question some of these things. Right.
Yeah.
And that's over the series of the podcast. I thought it was great because you seemed to think it was incumbent on you to try to address some of these things that he would sort of roll through.
I didn't like how he would get this historical momentum to railroad something at the end, right? Or this other thing that I had a problem with that he did was he talked about, well, this whole thing with adults having sex with kids, that's relatively new. That's, to me, that's not an argument, right? I know he's not defending pederasty when he does that, but it, to me, like, just apply that to an individual and see if it still makes sense. Like, when I was 4, I really liked to eat napkins and paper plates. So now I'm 37, yeah. And gosh, do I enjoy a mouthful of napkins and paper plates, because I did it when I was younger. So to say that all throughout history, people did this. So getting that running start to make arguments about the present or the future, I just had a problem with that. It just didn't sit right with me.
When we return, if it's all right with you, Brett, because this is Liberty Conspiracy and School Sucks Project,
sure.
Together with Brett and Jason and Gardner, feel free to contact us. I want to talk a little bit about moral relativity.
Yeah, sure.
Moral relativism. We'll discuss that more when we return. It's Liberty Conspiracy Radio and the School Sucks Project together. Gardner Goldsmith here with you.
Brett Vinat.
Osborne.
And we're very interested. If you want to contact us, the Skype line is open. We'll get that Skype phone number for the next one. That'll be good.
Yeah.
And if you want to contact us, it's gardner.goldsmith on Skype. And then we'll allow you next month when we do our super pod. Super Megapod.
Podcast Masters.
Together, then we will have our phone number so that you can contact us. And that'll be really, really cool. So Brett, Jason, guys, we were discussing overview of what you would your discussion with Thaddeus.
Mm-hmm.
And people can check out his work, Thaddeus Russell. And Jason, you mentioned the podcast with Joe Rogan.
Yes.
Yeah. I think it's interesting that a guy like Joe Rogan will talk to people like that, whether it's Stefan or Graham Hancock. It's very interesting. And
so when is he going to invite you guys on the show?
That's what I'm wondering.
Yeah.
When's that going to happen? Yeah. Right.
Do you need a certain number of YouTube hits or
YouTubians?
Yeah. I don't know what the criteria
is. Get there. I mean, he's got a book.
Yeah.
I think Joe just goes with, if he hears about somebody interesting, and so if he crosses radar, somebody must have brought him up to him.
He is a man of controversy.
Who, Thaddeus or Joe?
Thaddeus. Yeah, and he does like conspiracy theories. So
he balked at that, I thought, really.
Joe.
Joe does.
Big
so
time. Yeah.
Perhaps when you get around to writing a book, spin a little conspiracy theory story public education.
That's a great point. Maybe. Talk about the IMF, the Illuminati.
Yeah.
Yeah, man. Yep. I'll send him a Liberty Conspiracy t-shirt. Yeah.
But see, I pride myself on being able to keep things light and entertaining more than being I've heard people go on that show and they're just too serious.
Yeah.
They're just too knowledge heavy. It's like they're reading an outline and it's not good. Right. You need to be able to do T&D jokes.
That's a great point. And which is fascinating because, of course, Joe is a stand-up comic.
Yeah.
But he has so many layers of interest that he can get very serious about stuff sometimes. And sometimes, there can be some real doom and gloom when you get into the conspiracy side of things, because it's like, oh, man, they're all after us and what's going to happen. The market's going to crash. Everything's going to crash. Hey, maybe it will. I mean, even on my show, we're talking about Ebola and how bad things are with that and what the government is. It tends to be negative in nature because you're trying to defend freedom. You're talking about how bad the state is. And, it is a negative entity, and it becomes frustrating even when you're not a conspiracy theorist type of guy. So it's fun to be able to inject some comedy. So I think it's interesting that a guy who's a stand-up comic can have so many serious conversations like that.
Yeah, and Thad did a really good job on the show, I thought. And just to recap, if anyone's just joining us, the issues that we had with him on my show, number one, property rights. Early on in the series, we talked about him praising the Alt Expo crowd at one of the New Hampshire Free State Project events called Liberty Forum for smoking pot in this hotel. And he's like, oh, you're mad because that's like a property rights issue for you, right? I was like, I think. And so it was property rights. Later in a show when we were talking about FDR, he wasn't a big fan of Stefan Molyneux. Thaddeus, he didn't like Steph at all.
Interesting.
We invited him to check out some of Steph's work, and it didn't go well.
Wow.
So, he really didn't like. People are now trying to get me. I got an email yesterday about moderating a debate between the two of them, but I don't think either of them are interested in doing that. And wow. I don't think it has any point.
I'd like you to be the Arnold J. Rimmer, the facilitator from Red Dwarf.
I think I would just wind up being drowned out in that. And I don't see it lasting more than 5 or 6 minutes before one of them hangs up on the other one.
Oh.
I really see it going that badly.
Well, just to interject, though, yeah. on your productions, I thought you handled it beautifully. You did a great job in the conversation.
That not everyone agrees.
No,
but thank you.
No, it was great. And one of the things, you know, anything that I think gets me thinking and allows me to come up with slightly ideas that I think are slightly original, or you know, a take on something where I say, "Gee, you know, I wish I were there. I would have said this. I wonder what they would have thought." Mm-hmm. And just to go into it, you know, we were talking about the idea of truth and historians. And shading of the truth, motion pictures and things like that, and the very subjective nature of data acquisition, see, this is one of the things. If you believe in subjectivity, subjective valuation of things, this sort of thing, then you can say we can't escape our own subjectivity.
Right. Okay. Yeah.
Okay. Let's say, and even trying to say that that is a universal truth versus an objective truth. How are you going to define universal? How does one define objective, right? Universal that everybody believes that? Universal that it is?
I don't think it was so much the distinction between objective and universal. What I thought was that Thad automatically attached to the idea of objectivity a prescriptive force being used. Right. So making truth claims.
Yes.
But then what follows that historically is a prescriptive force.
Right. You're trying to apply that to me.
And the example that he would give is eugenics. Mm-hmm. Like, so we've established, we've made these universal truths about a group of people. So now we're going to carry out this action. Right. And he asked me a question at one point, like, if I try to sum up your essence, what does that do to your freedom? And his argument was that it diminishes my freedom if I'm making these claims about you.
Right. He says only you can define your essence.
Right. But the truth is, him doing that does nothing for my freedom if he's not a government, which is why I tried to say that the non-aggression principle is important. And I think maybe what he thought is like we were naive, thinking that we could have, you know, an evolving understanding of an objective reality, a reality outside of ourselves. In other words, that we are not making reality in our heads.
Right.
And property rights and the non-aggression principle.
But the thing about it is he applied it to morality.
Yeah.
You know, the very question of morality. And as I mentioned, you know, I believe since we are subjective beings, morality is in essence subjective. It just so happens that most people try to maximize pleasure and minimize pain, in my observation at least.
Yeah.
And I think my view is that when they come into contact with other people who are trying to do the same thing, they will either spontaneously or intentionally come up with innately or intentionally come up with modes of acceptable behavior. And those who don't conform to those, they will shun those or stay away from them. And those that do will come together and they will form a society. So the term morality gets mixed in with this because it's a question of morality, individualism, and the state. And it gets very reductio ad absurdum. And you say to yourself, look, I think that moral truths, as they're so-called, are subjectively determined. But I happen to be of the mindset that it just so happens that it looks like many people who have subjectively determined certain moral behaviors tend to hang around with each other. So they're pragmatic at first, but I think that they become societal moral norms, if that makes sense. Yeah. I mentioned that to the Ustream audience, but I wanted to mention it to the radio audience because in listening to your podcast, and I hope people will, this debate really started to close in on itself. It became a circular tautology in many ways, to be redundant, because people were unwilling to accept that the idea of subjectivity necessarily translates into people having their own morals. And it doesn't mean that they're going to be applied to someone else unless someone else thinks the same way.
Uses force.
And uses force. Exactly. If someone else thinks the same way, then they will be reciprocated.
Right.
If someone else doesn't think the same way, then will someone use force or will someone not?
Right.
And is that morally acceptable? Well, it turns out that if you try to, most people aren't going to want to be around you.
Well, since we're almost out of time, like I wanted to get into the School Sucks group. There was a lot of discussion about some of the stuff we talked about. One listener named John, basically, just to go back to the Thaddeus thing, said he had a better understanding of his point of view on the non-aggression principle, that we just live in a world with so much coercion and aggression that it's kind of pointless. It's kind of almost a handicap.
When Thaddeus got to the point, you know, when you were talking about attacking Walmart, because Walmart's a corporation and it gets help from governments, you know, my mind immediately went to, well, it's so universal that people are getting something from government, especially since the federal government and most state governments are in debt, and it's now being applied to generations unborn, where, you know, they are enslaving people who are unborn.
Yeah.
You could attack virtually anybody because people are driving on government roads. And
exactly.
It was brought up in your podcast. They said, well, old people are getting prescription drugs and welfare. Mm-hmm. You know, the power that we get coming into most houses comes from some sort of state supported utility or monopoly or oligopoly that is supported by the state, enforced by the state. So in all those instances, you say, well, you know, Thaddeus was saying the NAP is basically useless because it's so ubiquitous. Government intervention is so ubiquitous that the NAP is virtually useless. But I disagree, because the NAP is something that I think sociologically, not politically, sociologically, we can observe that we recognize the NAP.
Mm-hmm.
It fosters our betterment outside. And even with corporations, even though they are created, you know, corporate status is created by government, corporations still kind of compete with each other.
Yeah. Well, that's why we call it a principle and not a rule.
Yeah, right. Because, absolutely.
Yeah, we live in a state of not being able to fully make moral choices.
Awesome.
Well, right?
So
as long as I have it in my mind that I adhere to a principle of non-initiation of force, that's a lens through which I can view all of these gray situations that exist right now. So right now you're sitting there and I'm probably not going to jack you upside the head to take your Mountain Dew. Right? But...
And that's comforting.
Put the Mountain Dew aside.
Yeah. You know? But if I know you had just stolen it from a little girl outside, now I'm thinking, all right, well, I'm not going to feel really bad about violating the non-aggression principle, popping you in the nose and taking your Mountain Dew.
Yeah. Yeah. That's right. And these are often applied to dynamic situations. That's really what our lives are. But I think to say that the non-aggression principle is virtually worthless – really removes the fact that I think the non-aggression principle arose in so many instances because people were just among people. And that's really what it is. And I won't say you have to conform to the non-aggression principle, but I would rather not be around people who don't conform to the non-aggression principle.
Sure. And I think what it got caught up in for too long, and I think it's something that more and more people are trying to get away from, is it was a valuable tool in argumentation, right? Where most of the arguments that we have about a variety of issues is based on pragmatics. Does it work or doesn't it? Mm-hmm. Right? And people can kind of go in and find whatever they want to say, yes, it works. Look at this. And no, it doesn't work. Look at this. And it's always kind of a draw.
Yeah.
And it seemed to be, and Steph did a good job with this, saying, look, this actually puts the cards on the table. But that's another thing that's brought up in arguments. Is it moral? Is it immoral? Right? But it's saying, like, we're starting with this. So you tell me why this is wrong and we'll go on.
Yeah.
And people never say, oh, no, I think that's cool to do that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But Thaddeus was like, yeah. You know, I'd punch people if I could get away with it.
Burn
I'd
set down things. A Walmart.
I'd burn down. I'd be an arsonist if I could get away with it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. He's a scary dude. I wouldn't invite him into my house.
I don't think he'd really burn down.
See, but that's
no, because he wants to be friends with
he's,
you.
And he's this is the thing. He's sticking so much to his theoretical and his assumption that there is no truth.
And that was why I kind of came out wrong. But my real question was, do you live your life like 2 + 2 = 4? Or
exactly,
you know,
exactly. Mm-hmm. And do you commune with others who believe that 2 + 2 = 4?
Right.
Let's say we accept that the determination that 2 + 2 = 4 is purely subjective, even though through repeated trial and error through millennia, people have come to the same conclusion themselves that 2 + 2 = 4. Even the concept of 2 is subjective. Right? Even the concept of plus is subjective. Let's say we do that.
Okay.
Practically speaking, people through practice, through trial and error, through the marketplace of their own lives, because our lives are just a market for us to make decisions, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So markets are, by their nature, scientific in nature. It's trial and error. You know, it's I'll try this with my time. I'll spend this with my time. Our own existence, even on our own, how we make our own decisions ourselves, are our own markets within our own minds. It's our choosing to do this rather than that, to stave off this and do this now, all these things. So when we come into contact with other people, they're making those multitudinous decisions all the time, and then we make them with each other. Mm-hmm. So the practical and pragmatic becomes adopted by people, and they just start to do things with each other that I think sociologically they start to label it as morality. They start to label these things as moral. But as you say, do you believe that do you live as if 2 + 2 = 4? And he can say, yes, I do, or he can say, no, I don't. But if he says, no, I don't, if he says, no, I don't believe in the non-aggression principle, you can see the reaction he's going to get.
Mm-hmm.
So this is the sort of thing. I sat next to a guy in the airport in Heathrow, and this was before the Affordable Care Act was passed.
Yeah.
And he was in favor of it. And I just asked him the simple question. I said, listen, I understand that all my economic arguments and my constitutional arguments, you're not interested in those. Let me just ask you one question. Let's say you think you've got a great idea and you want this to happen. And I just say, you know what? You go ahead. You go ahead with your idea. Can you just leave me out? Would you force me? And this is essentially what Thaddeus is saying is, he's saying the non-aggression principle is essentially useless because government engages in so much force. But we as people, when we get to this face-to-face argument with the people who support the aggression of the state, and we ask them, would you force me?
Yeah.
It gives them a sense of cognitive dissonance. And I think it's because this is a thing where people, if they had to do it themselves, would not do much of what the government does. The government allows people to not adhere to the non-aggression principle. It's mm-hmm. the easy out. It's the curtain. And they can feel good about it. So if you can ask people, this machine still operates, and just because this machine operates, is this excusable? You say, no, it's not excusable. It's not right. And the reason they do is because in human contact with each other, nobody will want to be around them on a personal level.
It doesn't scale.
Exactly.
It doesn't scale down to the personal level.
Precisely. That's exactly it. You just said it in a nutshell. Done.
So why don't we get out of here?
Yeah.
Perfect.
Thank you for listening to Podcast Masters. And I will edit this down for Podcast Masters Selects.
I like
which
that.
Which is like the best parts of the show.
Slices. Perfect.
Yeah. Selects.
Very
like
nice.
A fancy cat food.
You can buy it and put the plastic back over and eat the rest later.
Yes.
That's good.
Well, that doesn't sound as fancy.
Oh.
But you can do that.
All right.